Okay, this morning we want to talk about the creation of God and God's government of the creation. We're going to take a sort of a brief run in the next hour and a half through this idea because it will be brought out by Gordon fairly clearly. But we want to talk about some things that he might not mention, different things about God's right to rule and so forth. Noise pollution. Okay. So we're going to talk about God's creation and the way that He rules His creation. We'll talk about some of the sticky areas that come up sometimes in the Bible. Now, number one, God has made an objective creation. It exists objective to Himself. It exists objectively. We saw last night that the value in the creation is intrinsic because God has made something to exist apart from Himself, and that the value is not derived. It isn't derived because of relationship. It isn't derived because of an identity associated with something else. It is intrinsic within the actual essence of the things themselves that they have value. And we intuit that value. We don't have to derive it from any place. So that you can use that when you're talking with people about their value. A lot of people in the world are really confused about their value because they associate their value with their place in society, the job that they have, their place in a family, the kind of income that they get, whether or not people like them, and so forth. And you can show them that that's not what God says about people. People are important simply because they're there. And their value is intrinsic. It's not derived from anything. Not society. It's not derived from your job. It's not derived from whether or not you even feel important. You're important whether or not you feel like it. It doesn't matter. Whether or not you feel like it, you're still important. Okay? Okay? So, and then that this creation is real. It's not subjective to God, and therefore it is real. God looked at everything He'd made, said it was good. And God always speaks of the creation as real, not imaginary, not part of His dream. We talked about this under Eastern religions. Okay, so it's objective to God, and it is real. And God always speaks of it in that fashion. Now, certain characteristics of the creation is that there are three basic areas of creation. There's the creation which doesn't have any life. That's what we call the inanimate creation. And then there's the area that has life but is not a moral creation. That is, we call the animate, non-moral creation. Animate, meaning having life, but non-moral. Animate, non-moral, like worms and mice and giraffes. Yeah, name a lot of things, couldn't we? Parrots. Found a silverfish in my drinking glass this morning after I'd already taken a drink. And I went, I looked in and I went, well, at least I'm glad it's still in there. Instead of finding it in my mouth or something, it crawled into my glass evidently and during the night and couldn't get out. And I didn't look in my glass to see if it was clean. I just stuck it into there and, it's a nice little silverfish. They always travel in pairs. Oh, wonderful. Well, I didn't feel anything go down, so. What? Oh, yeah, silverfish. It's a bug. No, it's not a bug. It's an insect, but it's not a bug. It's really bad living with an entomologist at the farm, because one day I said, look at this bug. And she looked at it very closely and she said, that's not a bug. And she described to me all the characteristics of bugs. Bugs have sucking mouth parts. They have this kind of wing. They have, can't even talk around there, man. I said, okay, look at this insect. She said, yes, it is an insect. What's that? Yeah, right. Had the wrong vocabulary for bugs. She's really interesting. She'll walk into a room and she'll go, see that thing on the wall? That can bite you and it'll hurt. One day I asked her about whether or not she had some insecticide for my aphids. We had trouble with aphids on our houseplant. I said, do you have any insecticide we could use for our aphids? And I got a lecture on the mating habits, the color, the ability of aphids to see colors at 30,000 feet in jet streams. I got everything, man. The whole thing about how they reproduce. And yeah. I don't think she had any. Anyway, very interesting. You want to know anything about anything? I asked her what a polyunsaturated fat was one day, and she was dancing around the kitchen showing me how polyunsaturates work. She's really, really a character. Huh, Hubert? Oh, yes. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, right. People she's never even seen before. She says, hey, look at this thing. So people come to the farm, first thing they see is an insect. I found one that did surprise her one day, because I found this little piece of moss crawling along. And I thought, is that moss? No, looked underneath, it had thick legs. So I took it to her and she said, well, that's interesting. It's an insect, and I think she named what kind it was, that has taken a piece of moss and stuck it to its back as camouflage, which I guess was an odd thing for that kind of insect to do. But anyway, I doubt that it had that kind of thought when it was doing it. But anyway, let's go on. We were going to talk about the creation anyway, so... Okay, there's the inanimate creation, and then there, like rocks, and then there's the animate non-moral creation, which you could, I don't know which, where you're going to include plants under that. Depends on your view of plants, whether you talk to them or not, I guess. Then there's what we call animate non-moral creation, and then there's moral creation. There are those beings that have intellect, emotions, and will, as God does, only on a finite scale. So we have the inanimate creation, the animate non-moral creation, and then moral creation. Now, in understanding the way that God governs these areas, first of all, we need to understand why govern. Why do these things need to be governed? Well, if you don't have government, then things begin to destroy themselves. You have chaos. If you don't have order, you have chaos. And if you have chaos, then things begin to destroy themselves. So there needs to be some kind of government. And God has provided for, because he felt the responsibility to do so, has provided for all the government that is necessary to completely keep the entire creation in proper order. But we'll see the problems with one area. That's we folks. Okay. We have the strange thing over there in the corner, but. We have the inanimate creation, and we have the animate, non-moral like animals, and we have the moral creation, that which has intellect, emotions, and will. Okay. Sorry about the animate there, but... Okay. Now, in God's government of these areas, which we're going to briefly go through because Gordon will spend a lot of time on it, in God's government of these areas, we see that he governs them with certain laws. The only way you can really govern is with law. And God has established certain laws, certain principles, rules of action, so forth. But there are different kinds of laws that govern the different areas of creation. A law is a principle of action or a rule of action. I have to use a broad term, or a broad definition, because we're talking about different kinds of law. And so, yeah, a principle of action or a rule of action. Because under different areas, in some cases it states what will happen, in some cases it states what ought to happen, you see, so forth. So, it's just a principle or a rule of action. Okay, so then, in his government then, he's provided for all that's necessary to keep the government, keep the government going, and he's done this by laws. But like I said, if we don't keep them straight, we might end up as Buddhists. Because the Buddhists say that one law, God only has one law, that governs all of the creation, and every single being fits into that, and every area of life and being fits into that. And so they have real problems with their metaphysics and their morals in that area. Okay, you see things like karma that we've talked about before is taking one of the laws of God and distorting it until it becomes one of the other laws of God and applying it to man. Okay, so there's differences between these laws, and we want to look at some of the differences between these laws. Now, when God governs the inanimate creation, that is like this piece of chalk, he has established certain laws under which it is governed. There's the law of gravity, works like this, you see? Okay? I think most of you are familiar with that. Oops. Lost the paper there. Okay? Now, that is a law of what? Okay, but what kind of law is it generally? It's a physical law. It's a law of nature, yes? It's a law of cause and effect. Okay? You put the proper cause into motion, and you get a certain effect. If you put the same cause into motion, you will always get the same effect. If all the circumstances are exactly the same in every case, you will get the same effect every time. So in other words, this is the law of cause and effect describes what will happen, what actually will happen. If you put a certain cause into motion, you will get this effect. Okay? So it describes what will happen. And the law of cause... Now, Kent, let me ask you a question here. Can this chalk disobey the laws of cause and effect? No, can't do that. Can't do anything other than if you put a certain cause into motion, it automatically does according to the laws that God has established in the physical creation. Okay? So then, this is a law of force. It can't do anything but do what the laws say it will do. Okay? The law of force. Now, under our other little place here, we have the animals, the animate non-moral creation. We've got our worms and our mice and our giraffes and our silverfish and our bugs, which have sucking mouth parts and however those wings go. We've got all these little things crawling around, and they don't have a will, but they do have life. And they are governed in a different fashion than cause and effect. And we commonly call the laws, although they're very difficult to define, we commonly call the laws that govern animals instincts. However, they're very difficult to define, and it's also very difficult to say exactly whether or not other areas of the creation, such as moral, have instincts as well. But we have... But we have laws of instinct here. And some of these, of course, are most amazing. You take, I come from Washington State. Anybody else here from Washington? From Washington, yeah, thank you. Yeah? Yeah, you come from, when you're from Washington State, you get to know a little bit about the, how the salmon live there. And very interesting fish. Salmon, fish. Okay, there. Certain kind of fish that lives up lives and grows and whatever, somewhat in the lakes and streams and rivers and etc. of Washington State and around the Northwest. They're very interesting fish because they'll go up and they lay their eggs in this one little tiny pool and then die there. Then the eggs hatch, the fish grow, they swim downstream, they go out into the ocean. They go from fresh water to salt water, go out into the ocean, they change their breathing technique, going into salt water, and they go out into the ocean and they'll stay out there for approximately 2 years. And then 2 years later, when they're 2 years old and they're good size, they come back and they go back up the same river, they go back up the same stream that they came down. This is 2 years later now, and they've found them thousands of miles away from the mouth of the river where they come out. They go all over the place, see, in the ocean. And they go up the same river, up the same stream, up the same creek, right into the same pool where they were spawned and lay their eggs there and then die there. And they will, if they can't get there because man has built a dam or whatever, which they found out they had to build stairs for the fish, etc. And if they can't get there, they'll kill themselves trying to get there. They beat themselves against the dam or whatever. The instinct is that strong. They will actually kill themselves trying to get there. So you find fish every now and then, you'll see salmon with big chunks out of their back and so forth from beating themselves against the rocks trying to get up upstream. But these animals have this thing built into them, these little creatures, that when they have this sense of direction that is just incredible. Now, not all animals have a sense of direction like that. Sheep don't have any homing instinct. appear to be notorious for being able to get lost and stay lost, and you have to go find them. They seem to go every direction as well sometimes. But we hope to have little lambs at the farm pretty soon. Yes, that nice. I like lambs. You're also going to have chickens. About that one. Yeah. We have rabbits, you know, they're really interesting. You let them loose out of the cages. They let them loose when they clean the cages, you know, just let them go. And they run around the hutch, but they won't go anywhere. They just run around the hutch. You know. Stay right there. So, and then if one gets out and it can't get back into its cage, you know, it sort of comes over to you and walks up to you like, here I am, put me away. Can't get back in. Interesting animals. But anyway, we talk about instincts, and it sometimes appears to us that some of these instincts could almost look as if the animal has made choice. And in some cases where people have been trying to either prove evolution or show some kind of connection that may not exist at all between animals and man, in their reconditioning of animals, we must remember that even though you recondition the instinct of an animal to respond to a certain stimulus does not mean that you've taught it to make a choice. Okay? And they're doing this like with dolphins. They believe that they're making the animal speak, communicate intelligibly, etc., etc. And really, all they're doing is expanding the grid of environmental influence over the animal to which it responds. And so, you know, you don't have to look upon it as that they've taught the animal how to reason, or the animal has, you know, only had to have that brought out or whatever, because it doesn't come up with anything new once you condition it. It only comes up with what you've conditioned it to do. Now, there are a lot of debates as to whether or not human beings have instincts or not. And C.S. Lewis seemed to think that human beings have instincts, but there are a lot of people that don't. And I don't know exactly where to stand on that, because, you know, well, we just can't figure out whether or not human beings really have instincts. But some people have said, you know, things like fear of loud noises may be an instinct like that. But there was a professor one time that was teaching on his psychology, and he had 300 students or something like that in an auditorium. And as he was speaking about whether or not man had instincts, which he didn't believe that man did, he was teaching, and he took out a gun, and he pointed it at someone in the front row, and he pulled the trigger, and it had blanks in it, of course, but it was a loud noise, you know. Five people in the front row just about had heart attacks. You know? People falling over going, ah! He screams, and, you know. And so, and then, you know, they realized that nobody got hurt. It was blank, see. So he put his gun away, and later on in his lecture, he pulls out his gun and he goes, bam! Somebody else in the front row. Well, not as many people flinched and not as many people screamed. Okay. And then later on, he was pulling out his gun and going, bam! Bam! You know, and nobody was moving. Nobody did a thing. And he said, you see? He said, if that were instinct, he said, I doubt that two times of conditioning could condition you out of an instinct that is as strong as we see takes place in animals. So what you have done is you've responded to something and you've thought, you've reasoned it out, and you've said, this is the way I'm going to respond, and you've made a choice. And so, well, anyway, he was convinced that human beings didn't have instincts, but there are all kinds of opinions as to whether or not, you know, they do or don't, or what? Yeah. Well, the question is whether or not that's actually conditioning. Okay. Yeah, well, how long does it take for a dog to get over being gun-shy? We try to train a dog out of being gun-shy. It takes a long time. It takes a lot more than just two times. Well, anyway, yes, we won't. I don't think we'll figure out all those things, but C.S. Lewis said an interesting thing about instincts. Although he believed that man had instincts and described man as having instincts, he said that still the governing factor in man is still cannot be instinct. Because if the governing factor in man were instinct, the strongest instinct would always win out. The problem is, man seems to be able, he said, to choose which instinct he wants to respond to. See? So obviously there's something above instinct in man that separates out whether or not he's going to respond to this or that. So therefore it must be something higher than that, and that would be the will. He described it this way. A human being sees a person drowning in a lake. Now, two things automatically come into play. His herd instinct, that is to save the human being because the human being is a part of the herd and preservation of the species and all that stuff. And then the second instinct that comes into play is self-preservation. And there's a clash between risking his own life and trying to save somebody that's in the lake or saving somebody because they're a part of the herd. So the problem with that is that different people make different choices at that point. And it's not consistent as to what happened. Some people just say, well, guess he's going to drown. See, seeming to be responding to self-preservation. And other people jump into the lake. See? And he said, it appears as if you can choose to which instinct you want to respond, so there must be some other governing factor. You can sort out, I'm going to respond to this instinct and not that one. And so the will, even if man does have instincts, the instincts would not be the basis upon which man lives, but would be the will, because you can choose which instinct you want to respond to. For his whole treatise on that, you can read Mere Christianity. Anyway, instincts in man, huh? Well, I don't know. Man has instincts or not. May not. So, then, we're talking about instincts. Instinct is also a law of force. The animal does not have a choice as to whether or not it will obey the instincts that have been programmed into the animal. Some very interesting things about animals. I'll tell you something about ants. Now, they watched ants for a long time, and they couldn't figure out exactly how it was or why it was that ants would be sunning the cocoons and eggs and so forth out in the sun, and then suddenly the ants would go frantic. And the ants would start taking the cocoons and the eggs, and they'd start taking them back down into the ground, and all the ants would disappear very suddenly. And they couldn't figure out what in the world was happening with these little ants. You know? They tried to sort out all or rule out all environmental influences like fear or whatever was taking place. And finally, somebody struck on the idea that maybe it had something to do with the weather. And so they started checking on wind and rain and air pressure, barometric pressure, and so forth. And they found out that as the barometric pressure rose, that the ants would bring the cocoons out and they'd sun them, and so forth. And as soon as it reached a peak and started to fall back down, the ants immediately went crazy, taking the stuff back down into the under the ground again. Why that? Because as the barometric pressure starts to fall, then there's a possibility of rain, and all those little cocoons and eggs could get flooded out or wet or whatever. And they had very sensitive instruments to find that out, and they found out that ants are very, very sensitive to barometric pressure. See? Here are these little ants running around. You never thought about that of an ant, did you? You know? Little barometers running around. So there they are. Little barometers. Or how about the grunion in California that know exactly the right wave to come in on, so that the next wave that comes in is either two or three waves or something like that later, that they'll be able to get back out again. And if they don't come in on the right wave, they get stranded. You see? But they always happen to come in somehow. They always happen to come in on the right wave. See? And of course, people take advantage of this. Run out there and scoop up the poor little grunion. It's a little fish. Huh? Oh, well, I don't know their breeding habits then. Not intimately acquainted with most grunion, but I don't know, they may do that. You know, that's a lot of animals have interesting breeding habits. Okay. Aphids have a more complex reproductive system than we do. I mean, as far as reproducing is concerned. Because they go through sexual and then asexual and sexual and asexual, and we don't do that. Aphids, little insects. I don't know if you meant the insects or us. Okay, now, yes, it's a law of force. The insects or the animals or the whatever that's under instinct cannot disobey the laws. And you see some interesting things of God's use of instinct over animals in the scripture. Most of you probably have sharing your faith manuals, or you will get them. Because Gordon used them as notes. Those are his handout notes, you know. Sharing your faith manual. You'll go, oh. Anyway. And in the back it has a list of the scriptures that are associated with these four areas. But anyway, under the area of moral law, in the way that God governs moral creation, we see two major areas. And the way that is used most frequently, is the area which we call free will. That is, because we are moral beings, the law that God uses in governing us is a law of free will. Now this law, by the nature of free will itself, if will is going to have any significance, and if the human being in the image of God is going to have significance, cannot be a law of force. It cannot be a law of force. Any time that we start talking about force in respect to free will, we're going to either have to talk about it in respect to the way the Bible speaks of it as the exception, or and the biblical norms on those things. You've been listening to the thing about Pharaoh in the afternoons, and so you know something about that. We're going to have to take those exceptions and those rules that God follows in doing that, or we're going to have to not talk about force. Because God follows the law of free will and deals with man in respect to free will. And you see, that's the major idea in the Bible. I've set before you this day the way of life and the way of death. Choose life, for why would you want to die? See? He always deals with man as free in free will, except in certain circumstances. And then, of course, he takes care of that by arranging other circumstances. We'll talk about that in a minute. Now, when God deals with man in accordance with free will, there are a lot of theologies that end up saying that man basically doesn't have a free will. You find that in Calvinism. Now, a lot of people say, I know Calvinist sub 1 is not Calvinist sub 2, because different Calvinists have different ideas, and some people believe in free will. But you look at things like Martin Luther in his Bondage of the Will, which the whole book is about how the fact that man does not have a free will, that the word free will is just weird, and man doesn't have one. Or Calvin, who says that the word free will should not even be used in the church because man doesn't have free will, says that in his Institutes. So should be dropped from our vocabulary altogether, and so forth. And yet it appears as if in the Bible that God commands us to choose and never gives us any indication that we're not able to do so. Always seems to indicate that we are able to choose and puts us in a situation where we are to choose. Okay. So how you would reinterpret all of those verses that, you know, commands that God gives us, command to repent, the command not to steal, the command to honor your parents, the command to be holy, the command to whatever command he gives you, if he gives you a command, it automatically assumes that you are able to do so. Otherwise, you would have to slander the justice of God in his telling you to do something that you couldn't do and then judging you for not doing it. Okay, so it'd have to be of necessity then, not a law of force, but a law of influence. You get the idea of force coming through in theology when you hear things like irresistible grace, that God irresistibly moves upon people so that they can't resist his grace and can't overcome it. And so therefore they have to become Christians and so forth. You get that kind of idea. Most Calvinists will not accept the idea of irresistible grace. but they try to accept the other sections of the system that sort of suit them. But the system is one whole system, and if you pull one of the pieces out of it, it falls apart. And that's what happened in the New England theology, in the New England revival, out of which Finney came, is that people started questioning specific points in Calvinism, and as they started questioning specific points, they began to see how those points were related to other points in Calvinism. And if they had to question this, well, then they had to question that. And very interesting going through the different theologies of the people during that time in New England, because you saw them very slowly taking down the whole system of Calvinism. And this, I read a book on it one time. It's a book Gordon gave Floyd, called The New England Theology. And it goes through chronologically the development of the theology and what people thought about free will and what they thought about man's government, God's government of man, and so forth. Very interesting things. And then at the end of the book, the guy that was writing the book and compiling the book made a conclusion. And he said, you know, it appears as if the reason the New England revivals didn't continue on powerfully into the 20th century was because that the people that were doing the study in theology tried to hold on to two things. They tried to hold on a little bit to the inability of man, that man is not really able to keep God's law, etc., etc. And they tried to hold on a little bit to the foreknowledge of God. And because they held on to those two things, the revivals went. Because the theology then lost its power. Really interesting of this guy to say that. Yes, interesting observation. So, yes. I wonder what would have happened with people being taught by Finney if they hadn't also been taught by Finney that, taught foreknowledge and taught other things, election perseverance, etc. I wonder what happened with Finney. Anyway, yes. A really cute thing happened. The new edition of Finney's Systematic Theology that's been put out by Bethany? The paperback edition. Well, Harry Kahn did some editing on that from page 480 on, is left out, because Finney never really taught publicly on that. He taught in Oberlin College, but he never taught publicly on it. And that's the things concerning election and perseverance of the saints and foreknowledge and that kind of stuff. And so Harry Kahn just sort of edited that out, and that's what Bethany wanted to do anyway, which I don't know if I agree with that or not. I'd rather hear everything that the person has to say, even if I disagree. And my wife, she hears of abridgment, and she goes, can't stand abridgment. Or modern translations, like Pilgrim's Progress in modern English, she can't stand that either. She says, if you're not going to read it in the original, just don't read it. Yeah. But anyway, Well, we enjoy the Greek a lot more than we do the English. Greek and Hebrew. My wife knows Hebrew. Anyway, that's beside the point. Maybe it's not all that beside the point, but... You know. Yes, where was I? Yes, Harry Kahn. It's really cute. Harry wanted to leave out there's a couple of paragraphs before that, you see, that are extrapolations of God's absolute foreknowledge and so forth that are in the section that's before that. And he wanted to leave those out too. And Alec Brooks didn't want to leave them out. He's doing the editing and publishing and stuff like that. He didn't want to leave those out. So he said, no, I don't think we better do that. And Harry said, now, Alan, as you know that Finney, knowing what he knows today, would want you to leave those out. Well, whether or not we agree, it's still cute, but... Huh? No, they didn't. They left them in. Anyway. Yeah. I thought that was rather cute. He's a real character. Okay. Yes, let's go on. Now, in this government, when we have influence... the idea of influence is that God has to communicate to the human being that which ought to happen, but will not be able to ensure that it will happen. See, now under laws of force, like cause and effect, you put a certain cause into motion, you automatically get the effect. See? It will happen in this way. So a law of cause and effect, a law of force, describes what will happen. The law of instinct describes what will happen. Given this stimulus, the instinct will respond in this fashion. Okay? Describes what will happen. A law of influence describes what ought to happen. The law of free will deals with what ought to happen, but cannot deal with it in the sense that it will happen. Otherwise, you don't have a law of free will anymore. The whole idea of free will is characterized by alternative. If there are not two alternatives from which to choose, you don't really have free will. So if a person has been determined by the way they're born, are determined that they have to choose to do evil, then you've eliminated free will. Because there is no alternative. Like this, you have good choice up here. You have choices that are good, say. You got choices that are evil. And the person is born in such a way that they can only choose to do that which is evil. Well, you've immediately eliminated alternative, so you've eliminated choice. Okay? So, you've taken away free will. Anyway, but get it out right now. But if you eliminate alternative, you've eliminated free will. I don't know. I think it depends. It would depend on how, what relationship that instinct has to other instincts, and what the environmental influences are as to, like, what the trees are like, what the, you know, whatever. Maybe I should use the example of spiders. There are certain spiders that build their webs in triangular spaces, and there are other spiders that build their webs in circular spaces, and some of them that build them in conical spaces, and there's all kinds of, you know, of ways that, but they'll only build in that kind of space. And so you put a spider in a place where it's completely round, and if he builds in a triangular fashion, you put it inside a sphere, it can't build a web. Because you've eliminated the stimulus for it to be able to build a web, because it only builds in a triangular fashion. Put it inside a complete sphere, it won't build a web. Because it can't do it. See? So I don't know if they have any discretion or not as to what they're going to respond. The problem is that a lot of the instincts are so complex that sometimes it would appear to us, because of our projection onto the animal, of being, you know, our being anthropomorphic with, or anthropopathic with the animal, it would appear as if the animal is making choices, when it's not really that way. All the dog lovers start throwing their shoes. Okay, so in the law of influence then, God can only direct information to the mind of the moral being and try to influence the being to do what is right, but cannot ensure that the moral being will actually do what is right. Cannot ensure that. Otherwise, the choice would have no value. Having a free will would not make you anything other than an animal if you had to choose to do a certain thing. Okay? Now, in God's government, there are times in his government of moral beings, there are times that for a temporary period, God puts moral beings under the other laws with which he governs the universe. That is, in some cases, God can take a human being that is normally under the law of free will and can put them temporarily under a law of cause and effect, or can put them temporarily under the law of instinct. You've been hearing about that in the afternoons with Pharaoh. He can do this temporarily, and we see examples of it in the scripture, such as in the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, or the strengthening, or the encouragement of Pharaoh's heart. Or as in with Balaam, when God made Balaam speak a particular thing. Or with Nebuchadnezzar, when God made Nebuchadnezzar an animal for a while. Now with Balaam, God took Balaam and put him under the law of cause and effect. It says, the Lord put a word in Balaam's mouth. Now here he comes to curse, opens his mouth, and out comes this blessing. So, you know, Balak gets all upset and says, what are you doing blessing these people? He says, well, the Lord's blessed them. I can't do anything about it. You know, so he opens his mouth again to curse and out comes this blessing, you see. The Lord put him under the law of cause and effect, made him do something that he wasn't intending to do. And he usurped his free will for a time. Now, there are the five. I want to mention here the five things, because if somebody doesn't listen to the other tapes, they won't get them. The five things that are important to remember here. Number one, in the scripture, it's never mentioned that he does this with a righteous person. It is always a wicked person with whom he does this. It's one of the conditions, one of the things we see, is that God never did it with a righteous person. It's always a wicked person. Some people believe that John the Baptist was under a law of cause and effect, but I don't know if we have enough substantial evidence for that. Okay, that's number one. Number two is it always deals with world history. Never deals with the person's salvation. With Balaam, it concerned blessing the nation of Israel. It didn't have to do with Balaam's salvation. Number three, it's always for a temporary period. Never permanently that God usurps someone's free will. It's always temporary. It always results in good to someone. We can't complain that God takes a wicked person and uses them and accomplishes some good. God, it always results in good for someone. We can't complain if God takes a wicked person and does something with them to accomplish good. We would complain if God took a wicked person and took away their free will as far as salvation was concerned. We'd have to complain. But God doesn't do that. It's always in respect to world history. And lastly, the consequences are suspended. The consequences are suspended. We see with Nebuchadnezzar, who was put under the law of instinct for a while and became an animal, that he lost his kingdom, his counselors, his glory, and then so forth. And then after his mind returned to him again, then he got his counselors back, he got his kingdom back, and it says even surpassing greatness was added to him. And God accomplished some good in his life. He said, the Lord knows how to humble the proudest of people. Oh yeah, I have to say that too. Nebuchadnezzar, if he does that. So Nebuchadnezzar came out the better for it, and the consequences were suspended. With Balaam, he came to curse, and the Lord made him bless the children of Israel. But when Joshua came into the land, God commanded Joshua, you shall kill Balaam the son of Beor with the sword, or Beor, with the sword, because he is a diviner and a sorcerer. Now that was what Balaam was doing in his spare time. See? And Balaam didn't get blessed because he blessed the children of Israel, because that wasn't his doing. That was God's doing. God made him do that. And so he didn't get rewarded because God made him do something that was good. See? But he did get killed because he was a diviner and a sorcerer, which was something that he did with his own private life in his spare time. Okay? So the consequences or suspended. So then, as God does this and puts a person under another law for a short time, and the consequences are suspended, doesn't have to do with their salvation, then we can't really complain that God governs the history of the world and sets out some guidelines beyond which man cannot go. In that God is being good to the earth, he's being good to the peoples of the world by not allowing the nations to get totally out of tilt, you know, the whole earth would go. It'd be a real riot around here if God didn't have some kind of government over the world as far as nationally was concerned. We'd be in a real state, you see. And so the only thing we can do is thank the Lord that he does that kind of thing and lets the nations go only so far. It's rather interesting with the nation of Babylon that he says, it was Assyria that he also used for judgment upon Israel. He says, I used you in order to be able to judge my people. But you went beyond my judgment, see, putting the blame on them for what they did that was beyond what God wanted them to do. And God said, and because of that, I'm going to judge you, and I'm going to destroy you as a nation. Okay? Now, we forget sometimes that the children of Israel came into the land, and God commanded that the Canaanites be killed. God also said, you live the way they did, and I'll have you killed. See, God wasn't partial as far as his ideas concerning sin were concerned. And when the nation rebelled against him and went after idols, the same way the Canaanites did, God brought in another nation and destroyed the nation of Israel. Okay? Took them away into captivity. He allowed a remnant to come back in his mercy. Okay? You learned about the remnant in the afternoon sessions. Okay. Assyria, yes. Well then, where is it? It's in Isaiah, I believe. Yeah, somewhere in there. Be good to read the book. With Assyria, then, God used the nation, and yet, when they went beyond what God wanted to use them for, and they were involved in all kinds of wicked practices in the midst of war, then God said, because you have done these things, I will have to judge you. The fact that God has said that he's going to do something, when we're reading prophecy or the fulfillment of prophecy, we must remember this. The fact that God has said that he will do something does not mean that because the person fulfilled a particular prophecy by what they did, does not mean that therefore it was okay for them to do that. Do you understand? Take David's attitude towards Saul. God had said, I'm going to destroy Saul, and I'm going to put you in as the king. But would David make any effort to do that himself? No. He wouldn't do that. So the Lord will take care of that. And he's left it with the Lord. Now, it's different with Jehu. He went out, and he says, you see my zeal for the Lord? And he went out performing all these acts, atrocious acts, and he says, I'm going to fulfill the word. He actually was consciously doing this. I'm going to fulfill the word which was spoken by Elijah and Elisha about these things. And he started going out, slicing up people and wiping out the house of Ahab and et cetera, et cetera. And so what does God say to him? Because you have been bloody, I am going to eliminate your house, like the house of Ahab was wiped out. Even though the word of the Lord was fulfilled through Jehu, he had no right to do that. You see? His atrocities were not respected by the Lord as being, well, thank you that you fulfilled my prophecy. See? God can take care of that all by himself, wiping out the house of Ahab, without having to have somebody else be rebellious and do atrocious acts. And so God didn't bless him. God said, your house is going to be wiped out just like theirs. I don't know. Never looked at it that way. Because Joseph ended up saying, you did it as evil, but the Lord was working for good in order that peoples might be spared. So it was in national history concerning the nation of Egypt and Canaan being able to be preserved through his wisdom. Could be. It's an interesting thought. I don't think I've ever had that before. Yeah, well, you think of all the choices that God has to deal with every day. I'm glad that's his responsibility and not mine. He's got the capacity to be able to handle that one. Okay, well, let us go on. So there are times then where God takes, Winky Pratt, and he calls us, says, this is free will, and he calls us over here a will freeze. Now, interesting. It will be called commonly, is it governmental providence or providential government? Providential government, yes. That's what it's, it's called in Sharing Your Faith manuals, providential government. In other words, God in providence rules over some circumstances. But we must understand the context of those circumstances, that he never usurps a person's free will in respect to their salvation, whether or not they have a relationship with him. Now, I'd like to talk with you about a particular area, about God's right to rule. God has the right to rule. And we want to talk about why he has the right to rule. What was that I heard? Yeah. He's obligated to rule, but why does he have the right to rule? Those are different things. He's obligated to rule because of what he understands about himself. Nope. The right to rule. There's two things about the right to rule. And we need to understand this in all of our theology because it comes up very frequently. There's a big difference between the grounds of something and the conditions of something. This is the basis. The grounds is the basis or the reason. The basis or the reason of God's right to rule. Why does God have a basis or a reason to rule over us? Okay? What gives him the right to rule? What is the basis of that, that gives him the right to rule? It's a different thing whether or not he meets the conditions of the right to rule. Okay? Now, let's use the analogy of a parent and a child. A father. Father and his child. Little girl. Now, the father has the right to rule the child. Why? Because he's the father? Okay, well, how is it that sometimes children are taken away from their parents and they're not given the right to rule? You're close. She said he's more able than she is. That's close. You just turn it around. She's not as able as he. That's getting closer. Yeah, that's even closer. No, that's getting back into something else. No? Well, then that would... All you're saying there is why he rules rather than she does. No, we were close there. Right. That's why. It's because she needs to be ruled. That's the basis of the grounds. That's the grounds or the basis of the father's right to rule, is that the child needs to be ruled. Okay, the child doesn't know how to govern itself. And so the grounds of the right to rule is intrinsic in the governed, not the governor, but the governed. That's the grounds of the right to rule. That is why it eventually becomes, because the child grows up and matures and develops an ability to be able to govern herself, that eventually, what happens? Yeah, but she becomes independent, and the father doesn't have the right to rule anymore in the child, because the child can then take care of herself. The father may have a right to counsel, may have a right to relationship and other things, but moved out of the area of the right to rule. They take it as in reference to a guy. A guy grows up, moves out of the house. Okay? The parents don't have the right to rule anymore because the child doesn't need to be governed in that fashion. Now, the child, of course, should receive wisdom from the parents and counsel and so forth, but the parents don't have the right to rule anymore. Okay? It's because the being needs to be ruled that the governor has the right to rule. But that's only half the story. If a father is a malicious child beater, he may have the right to rule because the child needs to be ruled, but he doesn't meet the conditions to rule. You see? And there's two aspects of it. The right to rule is based in her, and the conditions to rule are based in him. See? There's a division here. The grounds of the right to rule of the father is based on the fact that the child needs to be ruled. It's in the nature of the child. And the conditions of the right to rule are based in the governor or the father as to whether or not he meets the conditions to be able to rule. That is, he has to have wisdom, he has to have the proper moral character, he has to have the proper power. Okay? So then we look at that as an example. Now let's take it and look at it in reference to God and man. The reason, the grounds of God's right to rule us is that we need to be ruled. We need to be ruled. Now, Adam needed to be ruled with all of his intelligence, with all of his power, with an uncorrupted body, etc., etc. Think of the ability he had in his mind to be able to create a language. He's created his own language. Started out with no vocabulary and started naming things. Well, this is going to be a... just named it. Now that became the vocabulary word for it. Okay. Yeah, some head this guy had. Okay, so then, but he still needed to be ruled. Why? Because he was a finite being. Because there would be some circumstances that would come up because of his finiteness, he would not be able to know what should be done in that circumstance. Okay, so no matter how great his intellect was, he was still a finite being. And therefore, he needed to be ruled. And so, God expressed rule as the governor of the universe. And he said, don't touch that tree. Okay? So God was expressing rule as the governor of the universe. And we'll talk about a little more about that later. But then, so there's a difference then between the ground is based in us, that we need to be ruled. The conditions is based in God, as to whether or not he meets the conditions to rule. That is, he has to have not only the power to be able to sustain rule, but he also has to have wisdom, and he has to meet certain moral qualifications. If God were a God of hatred, he would not meet the conditions to have the right to rule us. Okay? If a father is a child beater, he doesn't meet the conditions to be able to rule the child. Okay? So he's got to have a certain kind of moral character. And so God, in every way, meets the conditions of the right to rule, and we meet the conditions of we fit into the grounds and give God the grounds of the right to rule because we need to be ruled. Now, if God governed us and God took a position as governor over us when we did not need to be ruled, if we didn't need that, then he would just be an arbitrary tyrant. See? He'd just be a tyrant, expressing rule where there needed to be no rule. You understand that? We commonly understand that if a government expresses rule where there doesn't need to be rule, where it should be left up to the beings themselves to decide, then that government is called oppressive, see? Tyrannical, or totalitarian, or whatever. When the government starts to step in, and that's, of course, the crucial issues in totalitarian, democratic, and so forth, is, you know, where do the people rule? Where do they take care of themselves? And how far shall the government go in telling the people what they are going to do? And as soon as the government starts to tell people more than they need to know to be able to govern themselves, it's gone too far. Okay? Get into a little government here. So then, we need to be ruled. That gives God the right to rule. That gives him the grounds. And then he meets the conditions because of who he is. He has not only the power, but he also has the wisdom. He also meets the moral qualifications. He is loving. Never done anything that's not loving. So there's the grounds and the conditions for God's government. Now, God is obligated, he understands this intuitively, he's obligated to govern us because of the reasons that we just saw. In that we need to be governed, he would automatically perceive himself obligated to govern because who's going to govern us? Okay? Then you get into the conditions. Who is qualified to govern? Okay? Who's qualified to govern the whole universe? Any finite being? Nope. You see? But the one who made the universe is qualified to govern it. especially because he's not only good, he's not only powerful, but he's also good. Okay? Winky Pratton has an interesting illustration in it. He says, you have to have both parts. A person has to be wise and good. You can have knowledge and be wise, but if you're not good, say, take a dentist. If you go to a dentist, the dentist can have all the ability to fix your teeth, and he can be the most tremendous dentist in the world, but if he's not good, you see, if he's not loving towards you, are you going to submit yourself to him? You sit down in his chair, and he says, I have the knowledge to be able to produce the most amount of pain you have ever been experienced in your life. You see? Well, you get right up out of his chair, you see? Okay, so he's got to have both aspects. He not only has to be wise, he also has to be good. And in this case, he also has to be powerful as well if he's going to institute things like, well, we had under here laws of cause and effect, laws of instinct, and so forth. If he's going to do that, he's going to have to be powerful as well to enforce the government. So then God experiences himself as obligated to rule because we need to be ruled and because he's the one that meets the conditions. And so he senses this obligation to rule and has expressed rulership over the world and over the moral realm of mankind. He's expressed rulership because he senses himself obligated to do so. He didn't make up the law. We've already talked about that. He didn't make up the law. He didn't say, well, now this is going to be right and wrong. But once he created moral beings that would understand moral law, then he would have to in some way become governor over them to try to preserve chaos and keep them from destroying themselves. Preserve chaos. Preserve order. Keep from chaos. Preserve chaos as well. To try to preserve order and keep people from destroying themselves, and for the highest well-being of the beings that he was governing, then he felt himself responsible to govern. And so he expressed government. And you see it expressed in things like the Ten Commandments, his dealings with the children of Israel, his dealing with Adam, with Abraham. You see it expressed all the way through that he has taken a position as governor. Now that's because he senses himself responsible. It's not just because he created us that he senses himself obligated to take care of the situation. Not just because he created us. Although when he created us, and when he contemplated that, he would also have to contemplate the fact that he would have to be responsible to be the governor. See? So it's included in the idea of creation. But it isn't just because he created us that he senses himself obligated. It's because of the kinds of beings that he created and the fact that he's the only one that's qualified to govern. That he senses himself obligated to take the role as governor. Okay? Wasn't an arbitrary thing he did. He sensed himself obligated by law to take the role. And so he's fulfilling a responsibility by being governor of the universe, especially moral governor. He's fulfilling his responsibilities. It's not just because he's good that he sensed himself obligated, although that's part of it. He's the one that meets the conditions. But it's not just because he's good, and it's not just because he's powerful. Okay? But it's because we need it. Okay, yes, well, let's go on. Well, I've already said that. Little notes off on the side here, but I've already taken care of those. Okay, now, it's a really important point. I've already said it, but I'm going to say it again. God takes his position as moral governor in the universe, that we're speaking specifically with respect to man now, takes his position as moral governor of the universe because he senses himself responsible. It's not an arbitrary thing that he's doing. It's not a power trip that he's on. It's not an ego thing, you see. It's not that he's selfish. Once, you know, I'm going to be the ruler. But it's because he senses himself responsible to do so that he steps in and fulfills his responsibility that he has to govern the universe. And so therefore, he is doing something that is loving and kind by taking that position. Yeah. in order to try to keep us from destroying ourselves, he had to express some kind of rule. But the thing is, he could not ensure that we would not destroy ourselves without usurping our free will. He couldn't ensure that. He could only hope that it would come out that way. Yeah. Okay, so then, God isn't emotionally bound to his government. God is not emotionally bound to his government. His emotions are involved in his government, for sure. But his emotions are not, he's not emotionally bound to his government in this sense. He has no emotional stock in his government because, number one, he didn't make up the law. He is expressing the law that he has understood for all eternity. And when he created us to perceive that law along with him, then he expresses government to try to get us to live in accordance with that law, but not because he made it up. Let's take it from the other point of view. Let's say I'm God now, and I make up this moral law. This is right and this is wrong. And I have chosen that this is going to be right and this is going to be wrong. And I make these creatures, you see, and I say, now, this is what I'm saying. I'm going to say that this is right and this is wrong, and you live in accordance with this. Okay? And you were to live that way, and he's arbitrarily made up the law. And then when the people don't live in accordance with the law that he has made, then he can get upset emotionally because he has an emotional stock in his law that he's made up. He's got his emotions invested in that because he chose to bring it about. Okay? But if you look at it from the other direction, which we've already talked about, that if God did not make up moral law, but it's basically a law of nature, and he creates beings that exist along with himself to be able to perceive in the same fashion that he does moral law, then when he expresses government, it's in this fashion. Live according to the way that you know is right because it's for your own good. I live this way and I recognize that this is for the good of the universe, and now that I've made you to live in the same way and you perceive the same law that I perceive, do what's right. You see? For your own good and for the good of the universe, do what's right. And we see that expressed in the scripture. I have commanded the things that I have commanded this day for your good. See? Not because he just wanted to be the ruler of the universe, but for our good, he commanded those things.